Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour. Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Law Hour is an education service in public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, economics, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on eminent domain, the Kelo case, when we come back. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there is no cause for alarm. But submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. Our Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Now, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes, our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from the political process, certainly not from the politicians, certainly not from the lawyers, and certainly not from the bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America today is in our courts, not in politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call the law school direct, 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Remember, it's free of charge. And courtroom strategy and procedure, our school on this thing of the 28 elements to defending yourself in court, is on a compact disc for home education. That's the school. It's on compact disc. You don't have to come here. You can do it right there at home. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the Kelo case, reading a comment made by Nicole Sherrick. Commentary, "Is your home next?" We didn't quite finish her commentary. I'm on page 2, in which Nicole Sherrick says, "But even though the Constitution states that property may only be taken for public use and not for a private use at all, the Supreme Court held that these kinds of condemnations are perfectly okay." Well, I answered that last time. I said, well, Mrs. Kelo's property, number one, wasn't private. Number one, weren't private property. The best that Mrs. Kelo could argue is that it was a split estate. Remember, she's paying property tax on it. And if she's not paying property tax, then she had to have had an allodial freehold title, and then that would give us a little different twist on this. Not that the government couldn't take it, but we'd have a different twist on whether or not it was being taken for public or private use. Now, she asked the question, is this property, or the use of this property, the purpose that's being taken, public use? And the court answered that question, yes. I think that the real question that needed to be asked and answered is, am I getting just compensation? It's my contention that if she got less than $1.5 million for her home site, she's getting screwed. She might have been entitled to $3 or $4 million for her home site, because the intended purpose is to turn that into a commercial development. And the people across the street from her are going to fall into that windfall profit. Their property is going to be zoned commercial, but it's not going to be taken away from them. And then when McDonald's wants to locate a McDonald's restaurant across the street from this new Holiday Inn that they're going to build on Mrs. Kelo's property, the guy across the street is going to get paid anywhere from 5 to 10 times the amount that Mrs. Kelo is going to get paid for her property, and he doesn't even have to vacate. And he's going to make a private transaction. Now, of course, that's commercial, and Mrs. Kelo is involved in commerce. Mrs. Kelo's property is commercial. It's not private. It's my contention. I'm going to prove it to you as we progress along. Now, she goes on to say, now remember, this is a report. This is a treatise written by Nicole Sherrick. It's commentary. Is your home next? She wrote this July 5th, 2005, so it's pretty up to date. She goes on to say, so much for man's home is his castle. Now, I answered that question in the last program. I said, you know, Mrs. Kelo's house is not her castle. Under the common law, a man's home is his castle. Under the Commerce Clause, a man's home is a piece of commercial chattel that can be condemned and taken at any time by the real owner. And in this case, that's New London, Connecticut. I'll show you why in a minute. So much for a man's home is his castle. After last week's decision, even if you have lived in your home for 30 years, the government can condemn your property and let Costco build a store on it. And if the government decides a Walmart parking lot would bring in more tax revenues than your home, you'd better start packing your things. So what else is new? It's been that way, you know, since House Joint Resolution 192. It got started with zoning and planning. Now, I don't hear anybody complaining about zoning and planning. New London, Connecticut wouldn't have even been in this game without zoning and planning. Without building permits and zoning and planning, by what authority would New London make the condemnation? What would they be condemning it for? Wouldn't have any power. But I don't hear anybody complaining about the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto and plank number one, which calls for the abolition of all right to property, which is implemented by zoning and planning and building permits. Now, this concept of eminent domain goes back to King David. I'll show you that as we progress along. Ahab and Jezebel condemned a piece of property and stole it from a fellow. One case was done correctly, the other case was done incorrectly. So the Bible gives us two examples of eminent domain actions. And I pointed out to you last time that Mrs. Keller is not complaining about the taking of the property. She's not arguing that the Navy couldn't take her property and put a submarine base there, or that the U.S. Postal Service couldn't take it and put a post office there. She's complaining about New London taking her property and putting a hotel there. And I'm sitting here saying, what difference does it make if the government takes your property and builds a submarine base, the government takes your property and builds a post office, the government takes your property and gives it to Bill Gates? Isn't it just as gone? If your property is taken, boys and girls, it's gone. Ain't it? So now if the government has taken your property and your property is gone, what's your remedy? It's called just compensation. Now, politically, I agree that government shouldn't come in here and take people's houses. Government shouldn't come in here and take private property. But there's a little difference here, you know, between private property and public property as delineated in Hale versus Hinkle. Do you remember that old-timey case decided back in 1905? We'll take that up when we get through with Nicole's argument. Now, Nicole asks this question. She says, how do we stop these abuses? All right, Nicole, tell us what's your plan? How would you stop these abuses? The Supreme Court acknowledged in Keller that state governments can enact more restrictive measures to limit the eminent domain power that each state can wield. California, for example, already has a law that only allows cities to take land for economic development purposes if the area has been designated as blighted. But because the term blighted is not defined, it is all too easy for cities to declare that even clean and productive land is blighted. Well, I pointed that out in the last program. It's a subjective determination. Who's going to play God here and tell you whether or not it's blighted? Who's going to tell you whether or not you can drive your new Lexus, but I can't drive my old Chevy? You know, when we used to deal in this country with property and property rights, the government kept its nose out of other people's private property business. But when we made the shift from property to commerce, well, then we opened Pandora's box, boys and girls, and brought this issue under the Commerce Clause instead of property and property rights, which is protected by thou shalt not steal. So you can't have private property without a law that says thou shalt not steal. And when you replace thou shalt not steal with the first plank to the manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to private property and the application of all rent of land to public purposes, you've made the shift. You've made the change. Now, after the Keller decision, only state law can protect homeowners and small business owners from the abuse of eminent domain. Without the protection of state law that says public use actually means use by the public, your home may be next. Nicole Schierick, S-C-H-I-E-R-E-C-K, is a law clerk at the Pacific Legal Foundation, a nonprofit public interest legal organization based in Sacramento, California. Well, thank you, Nicole, for your input. And I agree with you politically, but I think legally that you're off point. And then I'm going to present my arguments as we progress along in this series of programs as to why the Keller decision was correct. And the surprise that I was confronted with was the 5-4 decision. It should have been 9-0 in favor of New London, Connecticut. And the surprise that I saw was that it was a split decision, and the four justices that are trying to argue that Mrs. Keller has private property rights are hitting the nail on the head when they say this opens Pandora's box for all kinds of fraud and abuse especially against the poor. And I pointed out in the last program, Chavez Ravine was a classic example. The city of Los Angeles came in and said, this is a blighted area. You 300 Hispanics that live in this neighborhood are living in a blighted area. And I'm sitting here saying, who in the hell gives Los Angeles the power to come in and say, hey, you people are blighted, so therefore we're going to throw you out? You didn't get that from Moses. You didn't get that from David. You didn't get that from Solomon. You didn't get that from the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You got that from the first plank to the Communist Manifesto is where you got that. All right, so let's take Nicole's commentary, and I'm going to put it right over there, and I'm going to take a look at Kitco. Here's an argument put up by Dr. Richard S. Apple in writing. He says, the beginning of the great land grab. Now, remember, these are just two articles. I probably had 10 or 15 come across my desk. Every single one of them was critical of the Supreme Court's decision. But I didn't see any legal analysis in any of them, and I thought, well, maybe it's time for us to take a legal analysis of it and see what was the court's argument. And I showed you here 12 words in the Fifth Amendment. And the Fifth Amendment says, the last clause, 12 words, says, after the semicolon, it says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. All right, so we can take private property, and we can take private property for public use, and we can take private property for public use with just compensation. The correct argument here should have been, is Mrs. Kello being paid just compensation for her property, not is this or is this not a public use? The courts have already answered that question clear back in the 50s, and I mentioned Chavez Ravine because it is one of those most egregious examples of preying upon the poor. Now, I would submit to you that the baseball team, what is this, the Los Angeles Dodgers, could have bought those 300 houses for $1 million each and paid $300 million for those 300 houses, and that would have been more than adequate compensation. Because I would submit to you today that that piece of real estate known as Chavez Ravine, where Dodger Stadium is located, is worth a hell of a lot more than $300 million today. And they went in there and condemned that property, and they took it at the existing residential, depressed, blighted property values. One guy got paid $9,000 for his house. Now, this was back about 1950, as I recall. And they came in and promised these people, and they said, look, we're gonna take your property, pay you cash, and then we're going to give you first option to rent down here in these new Cabrini Green high-rise buildings. Well, the city took their property. They never built these high-rise buildings, and then later sold the property to the Brooklyn Dodgers. What difference does it make to these people that were screwed out of their property whether you build a baseball stadium or a high-rise apartment complex? They were just as homeless one way or the other, weren't they? Now, we've got a system in this country that we have adopted called the 10 Planks to the Communist Manifesto. We've got zoning and planning. That's as communist as you can get. I don't hear anybody complaining about the 10 Planks to the Communist Manifesto or zoning and planning, but then when you implement these socialist principles and philosophies, it includes taking Mrs. Kello's house because it's not private property. Ah, and well, you could argue she's got split estate, and that's right, and the government's going to pay her what they think the split estate is worth, but it's not private property. It's public property to start with a split estate aspect to it. Now, Dr. Apple wrote this on June 5th, and he said, June 27th, 2005 will likely go down in U.S. history as the day when the American people lost one of the inalienable rights bestowed upon us by our founding fathers. For to our detriment, it was on that fateful day that the Supreme Court of the United States expanded its interpretation of a major tenet of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. Dr. Apple, with all due respect, let me change the date to June 5th, 1933. That was the fateful day. June 27th, 2005 is just an ancillary event that transpired because of June 5th, 1933, and that event was House Joint Resolution HJR 192. And it deals with thou shalt not steal and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. It deals with gold and silver coin and the right to property and property rights. Dr. Apple goes on. He says, eminent domain is defined by my Webster's Dictionary as the power of the state to take private property for public use with payment of compensation to the owner. And this is granted by the Fifth Amendment. Prior to past Monday, this power was relatively sparingly utilized by various local, state, and federal governments. Well, just because it was sparingly used doesn't mean that it could not have been used more often. Just because the government didn't take your house last month doesn't mean that they can't take your house this month, next year, or 10 years from now. I live with that problem right here. I live next to a highway that they're talking about straightening out. When they straighten it out, they're going to put it through just south of my house. And I'm sitting here saying, well, okay, if you're going to put it through south of my house, we're going to build a highway, we're going to use eminent domain, and they're going to condemn my property. They're going to come in and offer me $1,000 an acre, and I'm going to turn it down, and I'm going to go to litigation. I'm going to say, well, here's what my property is really worth, and I want you to pay me what it's really worth based upon just compensation, not based upon are you going to take it for public purpose or not. Now, let's learn a valuable lesson, boys and girls, and that's this. If you go into an appellate court and you ask that court the wrong question, the appellate court will give you the correct answer to your wrong question, because that's what you ask. And the theory is, if you didn't want to know, then why did you ask? And now that you asked, let us answer your question. Now, Mrs. Kello maybe knew what she was doing, and maybe she wanted to test that particular question. Is this a public purpose? But when you do that, you run a risk, because now you shut off all debate on the real issue, which is, am I going to get just compensation? My position has been, since House Joint Resolution 192, when we abolished private property in the United States, that, okay, you can take my property, but pay me for it, and then I'll go buy something somewhere else. So back in the 30s and 40s, they started testing this, and the Supreme Court said, well, yeah, they can do this. They can come out and they can declare this blighted, and we're going to rebuild this area. They did it in West Oakland, California, put the Nimitz Freeway through there. And there's many cities and many examples of blighted areas that have been taken over by the city. Can you show me any place in the Constitution where our founding father said when you have blighted cities, the city should come in with zoning and planning, declare it blighted and rebuild it? It's not unconstitutional, but it sure as hell isn't constitutional. It's not provided for in our Constitution, but if we want to do it, we can, and we do that politically. Now let me break in here and show you what Utah's done. Now remember that Nicole Sherrick said that California, they've got a law in the books, and they call it blighted. Well, right after, well, actually the law was enacted before this, and before this case was taken, but in Utah, the Utah legislature went a step further, and they said, well, you can't, I was looking for the Utah paper here, just bear with me, if I've got it, I'm going to read it to you. If I don't have it, I guess I won't read it to you. In the year 2000, just a recent, not a decision, but I guess I don't have it. Well, let me just tell you what I can remember of it. Utah enacted a law here in 2005 and said cities can't take houses, private property, they call it houses, for urban renewal or other purposes, turning it over to another developer to increase the tax revenue, which is what the Supreme Court said. Now, if Connecticut doesn't have such a law, then you people in Connecticut need to go to your legislature and hound them and say, well, here's what we want. We're going to be practicing communists, but we don't want to practice communism to this extreme. We don't want to abolish our communist ideology. We just want to abolish the effect that this communism brings upon us by taking our homes. It would seem like to me that we should abolish communism, that is the first plank to the manifesto, along with zoning and planning, which would take the city and urban renewal right off the board. Then you wouldn't have that problem. Then Costco and Walmart would have to come negotiate with you eyeball to eyeball. They couldn't condemn the property. Now, the city could still condemn the property for their use. They couldn't condemn the property for somebody else's use. That's the important difference. Now, Mr. Apple goes on to say, when a property was condemned under eminent domain, it was typically done to acquire land along the right-of-way for building a railroad or roadway, supplying water, or for the construction of a government facility such as a post office or a prison. Let me pause right there. Now, when a railroad wants to build a piece of property or build on a piece of property, or when a power company comes through, these are called public utilities. Let me ask you this. Can you tell me what the difference is when the Union Pacific Railroad comes in and condemns your property, Mrs. Kello, and puts a spur or a siding across your piece of property for public use? Aren't you just as out your property as if you gave it to Walmart or Costco? Or Holiday Inn or some other private developer? When the power company comes in and takes your property and puts power lines across it, aren't you just as burdened by the power company taking your property as you would be by Union Pacific Railroad or Costco or Walmart or the city of New London, Connecticut? You see, here's my point. Instead of arguing over what is the use that the city is going to put this property to, that is, I disagree with the use that you're going to put it to. I disagree with you building a Walmart store. I disagree with you building a railroad siding. I disagree with you building a submarine base here. Instead of disagreeing with the government, why don't we get on point and say, okay, well, you're going to take my property. How much is it worth? Just compensation is what's provided for in the Constitution. The federal Constitution does not provide for what is or is not a public use. That's a fact determination. But rather, how much am I going to get paid, and is this just or unjust? I contend that it's unjust because you're getting paid residential property value for commercial property. When the railroad comes through with that spur, that's commercial. That doesn't have anything to do with the need of the public to have a highway come through here or build a post office. That's commercial. And the minute that it's commercial, let me give you an illustration. There was a guy down in Tempe, Arizona, and this guy was on a very valuable corner. His daddy, back about 1950, before Tempe had even built out here, built a little shop, built a brake shop, a little garage on this intersection. Well, as the years went by, this intersection, two major boulevards or highways, was swallowed up by the city of Tempe. And this guy is sitting on one of the prime pieces of real estate in Tempe, Arizona. He's got a little brake shop here. And then down the street, there's a True Value Hardware store. And they look at that and they say, well, let's go to the city council and have them condemn that corner and we'll build our True Value Hardware store down here. And as it turned out, I think this guy turned them away. But my question was this, why does the hardware store want that particular corner? And in real estate, we would answer it, location, location, location. It's not the value of the building that's on it. It's not the value of the rocks and the dirt and the sand and the gravel and the mineral that's under the building. It's the location. That location is worth millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's worth millions of dollars in taxes. It's worth millions of dollars in profit. And look who's standing in our way. We've got this little guy with a brake shop, and he's standing here on this veritable commercial gold mine. Now, you know, the hardware store could have come to this guy and said, we'd like to build a hardware store here. You got the most valuable corner in Tempe, Arizona, and we'd like to buy it. Now, if they were honest, they'd say, but we don't want to buy it for its real value, which is probably $25, $30, $40 million. We want to buy it for the value of this brake shop, which probably does $100,000 a year in business and probably pays $10,000 a year in taxes to the city. So we want to pay you about $100,000 for this property, certainly no more than $1 million, certainly not $5, $10, $15, or $20 million. So they use the vehicle of eminent domain. Now, the four dissenting judges said that's what we're opposed to. I couldn't agree with them more. I agree. Well, again, we're not talking about property here, boys and girls. We're talking about commerce. Commerce. And government has the power under the Commerce Clause. It's like carte blanche. I think that government should have that commerce carte blanche card taken away from them. And the way you do that is to go back to gold and silver coin, repeal the Federal Reserve Act, and repeal zoning and planning, and go back to private property. But you know, Americans have a split personality. We want to practice communism, but we don't want the side effects that come from it. It's kind of like a drug addict. He likes the high that he gets from heroin, but God, he just really hates the letdown. He hates the side effects. It's the way drugs are. All drugs have a side effect. I mean, you got to take the good with the bad. Got to take the bad with the good. So the moral to the story is, as long as you're sitting here on a piece of commercial property, and as long as you're dealing in commerce under the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, yeah, that hardware store can go down to the city council and say, listen, how much tax is he paying on that corner? We'll come in and build a hardware store, and we'll pay 10 times that much tax. Well, of course, the city council is going to say, well, that just makes good business sense. And after all, the city of Tempe is a business, and the hardware store is a business, and the brake store is a business. And so are all of the houses and all of the people that live in Tempe, Arizona, in those homes. Those are businesses. Those are commercial enterprises. And they're regulated under the Commerce Clause in Hale versus Hinkle. Now, let me give you another little story here that's a little off to the side, but it's very important as we're dealing with this thing of property rights. In a little town called South Tucson, Arizona, they had a policeman get hurt on the job down there, and he sued the city for $3 or $4 million, and he was awarded $3.5 million. Well, this isn't Tucson, Arizona. It's a little bedroom community. It's called South Tucson, Arizona. Well, they couldn't afford to pay this $3.5 million, so they went into bankruptcy court, and they said, well, we're going to declare bankruptcy, and we'll bankrupt out of this $3.5 million liability. So the federal judge said, well, what are your assets? And so they said, well, we don't have any assets, and we've got this big liability, and we want to bankrupt out of it. And the federal judge said, well, you can't do that. And they said, well, why can't we do that? And the judge said, well, because you've got all these assets. And the city council and the mayor and the council for the city said, well, what assets do we have? And the judge said, well, you got a city hall. That's number one. South Tucson, Arizona is a corporation. You own real estate. You own parks. You own alleys and streets. And you own fire engines and a police station. And you own police cars and fire engines and the public parks and all this. And we're going to sell all of those assets first. And then, if we're still short, we will go out here and we'll just take people's houses at random. Just take people's houses and sell them at auction on the courthouse steps. Joint and several liability, I believe you used that term. Joint and several liability. You see, Mrs. Kellow, along with all of the other residents, all of the other taxpayers, all of the other residents of the city of New London, Connecticut, are members of a corporation. They're stockholders in a corporation called the City of New London, Connecticut. And so New London came in and said, well, we're going to make some changes here in the status of our stockholders. I mean, we're all involved in this for profit and gain. We're not talking about private property here. We're talking about profit and gain. Now, that's a very vital distinction, boys and girls, because as long as you people want to deal in profit and gain in commerce, you can't be dealing in private property at the same time. I mean, you can be a whore, or you can be a virgin. But, boys and girls, you cannot be a virgin whore. Out here in the real world, we call that an oxymoron. So the four dissenting members of the Supreme Court are sitting there saying, oh, my God, look at the side effects that are going to come from prostitution. That's right. You guys want to be whores? That's fine. But, you know, once you become a whore, it just happens one time. You know, virgins are temporary. Whores are forever. Virgins are temporary. Whores are forever. And once you make that change, there's no going back. Now, you can go from virgin to whore, but you can't go from whore to virgin. Now, tuck that one away in your heart. Now, South Tucson, Arizona is a classic case, and tuck it away in your heart, comes under Hale versus Hinkle, and that's where corporations can be regulated and controlled. Now, I'm a little over my halfway point, and I've got to take a break here, and we'll come back and take a look at Hale versus Hinkle right after this brief message. Hey, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. georgewatch.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by simply calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit for the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Remember that the endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by us here at the Law Hour and Editorial Review or vice versa. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. We'll give you that one more time. That's area code 417-273-4967, or go to the webpage georgegordon.org. All right, we're reviewing The Beginning of the Great Land Grab by Dr. Richard S. Apple. Now, Dr. Apple writes, I think, fairly regularly. I get a number of these essays from Kitco.com. So if you go to www.kitco.com/ind/Apple, A-P-P-E-L is the guy's name, Dr. Richard S. Apple. There's also another website here called www.financialinsights.org. Now, that's probably Dr. Apple's webpage, www.financialinsights.org. That's all one word, financialinsights.org. I want to emphasize that I agree with both of these authors here, both Nicole Sherrick and Dr. Apple. Politically, I agree with you, but legally, I do not. I think the court made the right decision based upon the law. Now, if you don't like the law, then you need to change it. Now, I pointed out to you that in Utah, the Utah legislature changed the law. Well, that's the solution. And in Connecticut, you ought to change the law. Now, I think that the Supreme Court did that for you people up in Michigan. And this concept of zoning and planning and blighted areas like Chavez Ravine and taking people's property like you did up in Detroit for General Motors has been on the political agenda now for at least 30 or 40 years. People have been complaining about it. You've reduced this to a political question, so the solution is a political solution. And that's the way to solve that problem, is through politics. If you want to solve it judicially, then you need to be dealing with property, not equitable interests in property. Dr. Apple goes on. He says, when a property was condemned under eminent domain, it was typically done to acquire land along the right-of-way for building a railroad or a roadway supplying water or for the construction of a government facility such as a post office or a prison. Well, I commented on that before the break. And I said, now let's take a look at Hale versus Hinkle. And let me show you here, in 1905, the Supreme Court delineated this difference between individuals and property and property rights versus corporations and equitable interests, such as, here's the court's opinion, conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation and that he was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation with respect to the production of its books and papers. We're of the opinion that there's a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination of the suit of the state. So in effect, Mrs. Kello over here is in a corporate capacity. Corporate capacity. Now, he, that is the individual, is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. His power, just apply this to Mrs. Kello here. Mrs. Kello's right to carry on her private business in her own way, her power to contract is unlimited. She owes no duty to the state or to its neighbors to divulge her business or to open her doors to an investigation so far as it may tend to incriminate her. She owes no such duty to the state since she receives nothing therefrom. I'm going to pause right there and I'm going to underline that. She receives nothing therefrom. Hold it. She lives in the city of New London, Connecticut. She pays property taxes for the city's services. She receives a benefit. And it's hardly lack of due process or equal protection for government to subsidize or to control or regulate that which it subsidizes. I pointed out in the last program, you know, Mrs. Kello is regulated and controlled under the Commerce Clause. House Joint Resolution 192 comes into play. Now she owes no such duty to the state since she receives nothing therefrom. Hang on here, boys and girls. If you receive nothing from the state, you owe nothing to the state. If you receive something from the state, you owe something to the state. You'll see that in Wickard versus Feldman. I believe that's cited at 317 U.S. 111, I believe it is. 317 U.S. 111, decided about 1942, 43, long in there. And it's called Wickard versus Filbert. Now let's take a look at corporations. On the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state. It is presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. Yet the corporation receives certain special privileges and franchises and holds them subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of its charter. Yet the corporation's powers are limited by law. It can make no contract not authorized by its charter. Its right to act as a corporation are only preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws of its creation. There is a reserved right in the legislature to investigate its contracts and to find out whether it has exceeded its powers. It would be a strange anomaly to hold that a state, having chartered a corporation to make use of certain franchises, could not, in the exercise of its sovereignty, inquire as to how those franchises had been employed and whether they had been abused, and then demand the production of the corporate books and papers for that purpose. All right. So Mrs. Kello, she got involved in commerce, whether she intended to or not, you know, is another question. But whether she likes it or not, she's involved in commerce with the city of New London. She received certain special privileges and franchises from the city. Now, that doesn't mean that she doesn't have some property right in her property for which she's entitled to some kind of compensation. But the concept that she has an absolute property right in that property is a fiction. You're whistling Dixie through a straw hat here. Now, that's what happens under Hale versus Hinkle. Tuck that one away in your heart. Now, there's another factor, and Dr. Apple brings this up. He says, unfortunately, the recently handed down Supreme Court ruling has expanded the Fifth Amendment scope. Never before did a private entity directly benefit from the taking of the property of others through eminent domain. This ruling sets the stage for abuse. It has the potential to harm a yet unnamed number of ordinary citizens, to primarily increase government tax revenues, and for the benefit of a few private enterprises and individuals. Excuse me, Dr. Apple. I take exception to that. Chavez Ravine and the General Motors case up in Detroit are a couple of examples where government has, since 1933, come in and taken private property for public use. In the case of Detroit, they came in there and took it for General Motors. In the case of Chavez Ravine, they took it from these Mexican people, Hispanics, however you want to call them, 300 of them down there, and built a baseball stadium. And that isn't what they took it for. That isn't what they told those people they were taking it for, but that's the ultimate end use of the property, went to that baseball stadium. This has been going on, you know, since at least 1933. Now, prior to 33, I don't know. I don't see anything in the literature, but since 1933, taking West Oakland and calling it blighted and then redoing it, is old hat. It's been around for a long time, and the Fifth Amendment doesn't prohibit it. The question is it a public purpose? And when the city comes in and says, we're doing it to increase tax revenues, which will have the effect of lowering the taxes on everybody in this regulated enterprise called the City of New London, that's a public purpose. At least that's the Supreme Court's take on it. They say that's a public purpose. Should it be allowed? I don't think so, but, you know, that's the way it is. Like it or lump it. Now the Supreme Court, Dr. Apple goes on. He says the Supreme Court's finding was the final decision in the case of Kello versus New London. The city of New London desired to condemn a number of well-maintained residences along its waterfront and then transfer their title to a private company. Okay, now he brings up the same subject that did the previous author, Nicole Sherrick. She said, well, these properties were well-maintained. Well, let me put it to you this way. What if these properties had not been well-maintained, that they were occupied by a bunch of blacks and Mexicans, and they were a bunch of shanties? Are you then saying, Dr. Apple, well, that's okay. We can knock those down. That's a blight. That's terrible. I'm sitting here saying, well, why in the hell should we take away somebody's property, whether it's a shanty or not? I thought the principle was, at least it used to be in this country under our common law years ago, that a man's house was his castle. Whether it belonged to Bill Gates or it belonged to some poor, diseased, black itinerant or Mexican peon, for crying out loud, it's his property. Furthermore, God had something to say to that in Deuteronomy chapter 1. He commanded our judges to judge righteous judgment and that they weren't to esteem the rich and the powerful over those who were the poor and the needy. Now, when we deal in property and property rights, it doesn't make any difference whether this property is seedy, shanties, or whether it's property of Bellwood Estates. And so I would disagree with you here. I don't care whether this property is in Chavez Ravine or in Bel Air. What business does the government have coming in here taking this property for redevelopment? Well, that's the argument that everybody's making. And they're saying, well, they don't have a right to do it because it's private property. I'm here to tell you that it's not private property. It's commercial property. And under Hale versus Hinkle, Wickard versus Filburn, and a whole host and plethora of other decisions that date back to House Joint Resolution 192, June 5th, 1933, that's the root cause. Zoning and planning and building permits and the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, boys and girls, are your problem. You take away the cause of that problem, and then the problem will just disappear. But as long as you leave zoning and planning intact and unjust weights and balances in the form of Federal Reserve notes, you're always going to have this problem. It's because you threw it into Article 1, Section 8. You took it out of Article 1, Section 10. Well, Dr. Apple goes on, he says the 16 homes were to be torn to the ground, and in their place was to be built a series of buildings, including a hotel, condominiums, and office space. The Supreme Court, for the first time, found that this eminent domain transfer to a private entity fit within the meaning of the Fifth Amendment. I don't think so. Now, it may be the first time that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided this. I didn't look that up. But the Supreme Court of Michigan has looked into it, and our Supreme Court has ruled a number of times that this thing of taking property for urban redevelopment is certainly constitutional. So I don't think that this is the first time that this case, that this issue has come up. And I mentioned to you earlier, what the hell difference does it make if you turn it over to the Ajax Consortium of Building Contractors in New London, or you turn it over to the Union Pacific Railroad or Pacific Gas and Electric Company? I mean, this consortium that's going to put in this hotel is going to be a corporation. You can bet on that. That corporation is not a private entity. A corporation is a public entity. Whether it's General Motors or New London, Connecticut, those are public entities. Corporations are public, boys and girls. Hale versus Hinkle just told you that. Nothing private about that. And these people aren't taking. I mean, New London is not taking this property and giving it to Bill Gates or George Gordon. They're giving it to a corporation for redevelopment. They're giving it to Costco. They're giving it to Walmart. I can't see any difference between Costco and Walmart and UP Railroad or Pacific Gas and Electric. We call those private companies, but there's nothing private about them. Justice John Paul Stevens wrote, now this is Dr. Apple again, he says, Justice John Paul Stevens wrote, the opinion for the majority of justices, his vote in favor, was joined by Justices Kennedy, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. The dissenters were O'Connor, Scalia, Thomas, and Rehnquist. In rendering the opinion of the majority of justices, Stevens stated in part that the city was carefully, or has carefully formulated an economic development plan that it believes will provide appreciable benefits to the community, including, but by no means limited to, new jobs and increased tax revenues. And he went on to state that, to effectuate this plan, the city has invoked a state statute that specifically authorizes the use of eminent domain to promote economic development. Because this plan unquestionably serves a public purpose, the takings challenged here satisfy the public use requirement of the Fifth Amendment. I couldn't agree more. That's what I think. Here's another example. When I was in Idaho, the Hewlett-Packard people wanted to build a factory. They didn't know exactly where they wanted to build it, but they wanted to build it. So Idaho, the state government of Idaho, Governor John Evans, led the troop, and he went to Hewlett-Packard and he said, build your plant here, and we're going to give you tax-free status over here. No property taxes to pay in Ada County. Don't have to pay any state taxes, but we want the jobs that this plant is going to build, or are going to furnish here. And so Hewlett-Packard was being wooed by two or three states, and they chose Idaho, and sure enough, they built this factory out here in Ada County, Idaho. And I don't know what the terms and conditions were, but the state government came in here, and they're wooing these companies. Well, that's commerce. That's commercial. That's business. It's my contention the government doesn't have any business getting involved in the business of business, that government should stay out of commerce. But you know, once we started down this slippery slope in 1933, and we got involved with the Federal Reserve back in 1913, and the 14th Amendment, you know, back in 1868, hey, boys and girls, you know, this coupling of commerce with government has turned out to be a pretty bad can of worms. So you might as well get used to it, because this is the way the game is played. Now, people do this with drugs, you know, they teach their children, just say no to drugs. Excuse me? Since when are parents supposed to drugs for their children? They give them Ritalin every day. 3 or 4 million children a year are being given Ritalin. Why, these same children are being given 35 vaccinations before 5 years of age. I don't think that Americans are opposed to drugs or pharmaceutical companies. They're opposed to private drugs. As long as the drug companies are incorporated, you know, like Pfizer and Merck, and regulated and controlled by the FDA and the Department of Agriculture, and as long as we have doctors and licensed pharmacists prescribing these drugs and giving them to us, we're not opposed to drugs. What we're opposed to is private drugs as opposed to public drugs. And I guess the rational basis for that is that public drugs regulated and controlled by doctors and pharmacists and the FDA are safe. And so what we're really concerned with is safe drugs versus unsafe drugs. But when you take a look at the statistics, you find that of all of the illegal drug use in the United States, and I assume that it's quite a bit, they only kill 6,000 people a year. Now, the legal drugs, that is the doctors and the pharmacists and the hospitals, kill 130,000 people a year. What's the difference here? 130 divided by 6 is 21.67. So The legal drug users, the legal drug pushers, the doctors and pharmacists, are killing 21 times more people than the private drug users and drug pushers are killing. Now, I'm opposed to drugs, both legal and illegal. because it's the practice of witchcraft and it violates the law of God and it's bad for everybody. Heroin, smack, and crack is bad because it kills 6,000 people a year and it ruins a lot of lives. And legal drug use that's put out by Pfizer and Merck and the FDA kills 20 times more people than that, and it also wrecks a lot of lives, and it's also bad, and it's also witchcraft, and it's also bad. But you know, Americans don't come around saying we're opposed to drugs. Americans are in favor of drugs. Americans don't come along and say, we're opposed to zoning and planning. We're opposed to building permits. We're opposed to communism. No, they come along, we're in favor of communism and zoning and planning. We're just opposed to you taking our houses with this zoning and planning and with this commercial paper and commerce. We all want to be whores, but we want to be virgin whores. Boys and girls, once you adopted whoredom, you gave up virginity. You can forget virginity. We're already whores. We're already practicing communists. We're already practicing commerce. So Dr. Apple over here is complaining about our status. Well, that's already been settled. Now he says, the future of countless Americans will now be exposed to suffering in the name of serving a public purpose in a potential myriad of new fashions. This while simultaneously enhancing the wealth of some private enterprises and individuals. Well, hell, every time Union Pacific Railroad condemns a piece of property or PG&E, they enhance that corporation's wealth at the expense of the poor people whose property they took. And I just said, nobody's complaining about that. I can't see for the life of me what difference it makes if New London, Connecticut gives the property to some other consortium, some other corporation other than one of the established ones. I mean, let's be consistent. Let's be opposed to the theft of private property, period. Whether the private property is blighted or whether it's in Bellwood Estates, let's be opposed to theft, period. Irrespective of who owns the property, whether he's a poor man or a rich man, let's be opposed to the theft. I got to leave it right there, boys and girls. We'll be back tomorrow night talking more about Kellogg. But until then, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Time's up. I'm going to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.